Okay, so yesterday, to refresh your memories, because I feel like that is necessary. So first of all, we established the rule of Shuda de Dayane. So what's the Shuda de Dayane? So we saw there are three understandings, right? It either, according to Rabbeinu Tam, what does it mean? Ezra, Shuda de Dayane is cases in which we just tell the judges, do whatever you want. Do whatever you want. Rashi says Shuda de Dayane is cases in which we don't have hard and fast proofs. What we do is make your best educated guess, attempt to get to the truth. And then the bizarre position of the Korban Eida, which was you're allowed to accept bribes and decide based on that because you can't figure out the truth anyways. Or Ezra's sort of compromised position, which is maybe he has some weird psychological assumption like the Rush that whoever bribes more is probably telling the truth. I don't know, that's a good assumption, but it's a nice way of defending the Korban Eida, Ezra. So we said logically what drives that. So Rashi is easy enough. I mean, Rashi says, look, we're committed to justice, and when we don't know what the truth is, we do our best. Right? That seems to be Rashi's logic. Rabbeinu Tam, right, seems to be more focused simply on getting, you know, on moving on with life, right? That chayim element of the justice system. And therefore he says, look, we don't know what the truth is, so do whatever you want. You know, but let's just move on from here. Now, Ezra's question, which was, well, why don't you do Yachloku in that case? If you have no idea what the answer is, why don't you divide? The answer might be in a case where, right, Yaakov wrote, if I remember who we said this word, right, Yaakov gives a present to both Ezra and Rami, and he writes a document on the same day. So, like, at the end of the day, it has to be one or the others, the way Shmuel understands it, because as Tosfot understands it, Shmuel is going according to the position that Ede, Mesira Karte. It goes by whoever got the document first. So it's only one or the others. To split it would definitely be a miscarriage of justice, 50%. It would be 50% the truth and 50% a lie. And we might not want to do that. We might rather be completely arbitrary, where you have a 50% chance of getting it completely right and a 50% chance of getting it wrong, rather than a 100% chance of getting it half right and half wrong, because then you're directly facilitating at least a 50% miscarriage of justice. Fine. So what we saw yesterday is that the reason the Gemara seems to invoke this case, and I'm going to take Tosfos' understanding, I'm going to leave the Rashbam for now. The reason that Tosfos seems to understand that this case of Shnei Shtarot, right, where the critical moment for Shmuel, like Rabbi Eliezer, is Mesira, is when did Yaakov give the deed to Rami or Ezra? In that case, whoever got it first owns it all. What we're left with is a case where there's no chazaka. Why is there no chazaka? Because the chazaka would have been Yaakov, but Yaakov admits that he gave it away as a present. And therefore, we're starting from zero. Now both Ezra and Rami are arguing over something that they both admit they had no prior claim to. Right? So there's no option to revert to prior states, because this prior state would be Yaakov, and Yaakov vacated his rights to it. And we have an epistemic suffix, meaning we just don't know who owns it. It's 100-0. So in that case, Shmuel had said, Shuda de Dayane, whatever Shuda de Dayane means, either you try to figure out the truth or you just throw it up to pure whim. But that is, or bribe, and that is parallel to Zeomer Shalavotai Zeomer Shalavotai, where Gavi and Andrew argue about this property, both saying, neither of them have been living there for the last 10 years, right? Because they've been wherever, they've been living in America, but they both claim that this piece of land in Nahariya is their ancestral homeland, right? Ze'omer Shalavotai, but they both admit they have no prior claim besides for their historical claim, but no proof, because they haven't been living there. So now we have a suffix. In our Gemara, the solution is called Alengvar, fight it out to the death. So the Gemara's question, this is where we were yesterday, is why in these two cases, which are both cases where there's no prior proof, is the solution in our Gemara called Olim Gvar, fight it out, and the case in the Shtei Shtarot, the two documents, the gift deeds, the solution, according to Shmuel, is shuda d'dayne, is let the judges pick, whatever that means. Why are these not parallel? Right, that's what we got yesterday. Yes? Okay? If you didn't get everything yesterday, you should have been caught up now. So the Gemara says, what's the Gemara's answer? Hacha ika lemekam ala demilta. The Gemara claims that the difference is what? Ika lemekam ala demilta. What is ika lemekam ala demilta? What does it mean? And why and how does this conceptually solve the problem? Right? Remember, this is the million-dollar question. Why, in these two cases, which are parallel in the sense that, again, you have no proof of prior ownership, Bez Din is stuck in a situation without evidence, with two equal claims of total control, but our Gemara, in the case of the two fields and the competing claims of ancestral homeland, solves it through violence, called El Engvar, and the case of the Shnei Shtar, we solve it by letting the judge do whatever he wants. Why are they different? And the Gemara's answer is, Ika Lemekam Allah Demilta. So what does Ika Lemekam Allah Demilta mean, and why does it solve our problem? So we're going to see, there are many possible answers, we're going to see two answers, okay? Rashbam. Let's first start with Rashbam. Rashbam in Hatam. Got it? One, two, three, six lines down in the short lines, right? Hatam. Got it? Yes? Don't just rely on the source sheets. Anything that's in the Gemara, I didn't give you. Open up your Gemara. I know, it's tempting. This is why I don't like giving you source sheets. Then you think all the sources you have to look at are on the sheet. But no. The Yad Ramah is on the sheet, but I want you to look at Rashbam. Remind me, who's at 12 today, Rabbi Mann? What's today? Today's Tuesday? Oh, God. I don't know what day of the week it is. So Mikdash today. Okay. Tomorrow's our amen. Okay, fine. Yalla. I will try to be here. I will be here close to the beginning of Seder. I'm not sure exactly what time. My vaccine is like 10 to, is called for like 10 to 9 or something. Thank God. Second one. Down. I just got to hold out till tomorrow morning. But all of you got, so I'm so excited. Now you can just count down the days. What? 3 weeks. Three weeks. What? Oh, to get full immunity? They think about seven to 10 days is for full immunity. A week, 7 days after the second vaccine, they were testing 6 to 22 times the antibodies of before. I don't know. Yeah, whatever the government says is the standard I'm going by. Okay. So Rashbam. So Rashbam answers. He says, Hatam. Bidvei Shtaro. The case of Yaakov giving the present to both Yaakov, to Rami and Ezra. Leka lemekam ala demilta. You cannot prove it. What does that mean? Hayom olemachar sheyavi ha'echad edim v'yitol. Rami or Ezra will not be able to prove. Tomorrow, bring witnesses to prove they got it first. Why? Shaharei hashtarot shavin bizmanan, because the deeds say the same day. Va'afilu im yavou edim v'yaidu zenichta v'nimzar b'voke v'zeba erev. Halo ha'ein hakdama b'sha'ot. even if the witnesses would come, it wouldn't prove it. Now, remember, this is the Rashbam against Tosfot, right? Tosfot thinks that Shmuel is going according to the sheet of Eidim Asirakarti, right? But Rashbam doesn't think that, right? Rashbam thinks this is within the world of Eidei Chatzim Akarti, and therefore it is definitionally unprovable, because it goes by the document, and therefore it doesn't matter. And he says, as long as they're given in the same day, which is what we assume happened, the ownership takes place at the same time. Hilka Rav Avar Cholkin, Ushmuel Amar Shuta Dedaine. Dehoil Ve'ein Livarer Le'olam. Since it is definitionally unprovable, Hadin Imi Mishtadlin Betin Bedinan V'Doninoto. Aval hacha by karka deleka lo shtar v'lo edim v'ikam l'meka l'malo demiltam yavau v'yaidu al mihu hilkach ingan l'mer chaluka v'shuma d'shem yavau edim v'yistu et adin shedanu beizdin. But in the case of the shtei shtar of zeh omer shavotai, there's simply lack of evidence, not definitional lack of evidence. And therefore, we don't want to paskin. Why? Because we might turn out to be wrong. So since we don't want to turn out to be wrong, Yagav ain bezin niskakim len ladun din sheyasavu lidei ivut. We don't paskin in a way that will eventually be corrupt or wrong. Elamanichnota. We just leave it. The kol doling varach yavo edim viyavaru adavar. So the Rashbam brings together a lot of what we've been talking about, and this is why this sugya takes a long time, because he's a lot of building blocks. So let's take the Rashbam's argument, okay? Ready, guys? It's complicated. But let's, all the stages we're ready for. Okay. Step one. The Rashbam understands Zeh Omer Shel Avotai. The Zeh Omer Shel Avotai is a case where there is no prior claim and there's lack of evidence. Okay? And we paskin kol dalin gvar. Point two, the Rashbam believes that kol dalin gvar, remember we saw there's two possibilities, is kol dalin gvar a recusal or a psak indirectly? The Rashbam takes the position that it is a recusal. Why would Beis Din recuse themselves? Step three, because they cannot be party directly to injustice. So it's better to recuse themselves. So according to the Rashbam, the question is, why do they recuse themselves? According to the Rashbam, this is the real question of the Gemara. Why do they recuse themselves in Zeh Omer Shel Avotai, Zeh Omer Shel Avotai, and they paskin in the case of Shnu Shtarot, whether according to Rav by dividing it 50-50, or according to Shmuel by letting the judges pick whatever they want? Answer for the Rashbam is as follows. When Gavi and Andrew both claim they own this land, but have no evidence, they merely have no evidence, but evidence could surface. So what's the problem for the Rashbam? If evidence could surface but has not yet surfaced, what will Beis Din not want to do? Paskin. They, right, because if they paskin, they will. They stand to be corrected, and they don't want to do that. And therefore, what's the best thing that they can do? Temporary recusal, which according to them means recusal because they know that it's possible that in the future evidence will come. So why is that we let recusal, which entails violence? The answer is because we're assuming that one day evidence will come. And in the meantime, we're recusing ourselves in favor of letting the truth emerge at some point in the future. even though right now that means we're giving up on pretty much all of our values, right? The point is we can't be party to injustice. We'd rather recuse ourselves, which doesn't participate in the pursuit of justice, doesn't even pursue it in peace, right? But the reason that we're letting the state, the law, the legal system wait in limbo is because ikol amekim alada milta, the truth may emerge. And therefore, that motivates us not to make a decision which might turn out to be wrong. But according to the way the Rashbam understands Shnei Shtarot, it's different. Because he assumes that in the case of Shnei Shtarot, the suffix is inherent. Meaning, once Yaakov writes to both Rami and Ezra that they own the field as of Sunday, he holds that this is, they both own it equally. Meaning, it's an inherent. It's not that they both own 50%. It's they both have equal claims to 100% because Yaakov has created a fundamental doubt, which is unresolvable because it's a legal doubt. He's given equal full rights to both Ezra and Rami. The doubt is inherent. If it's inherent, no proof can ever change it. Lekem lemekem ala demilta. You can't prove it because it is inherently unclear. If it's inherently unclear, then Beis Din can never be proven wrong. If Beis Din can never be proven wrong, then they can make it, right? And it can never get better. No new evidence can ever come because it's inherently suffix. So then they might as well make a decision. Why? Because as we said, what's the most basic obligation of a court? It's to make sure society functions. If they think the truth might come out in the future, they can temporarily recuse themselves. But they won't permanently recuse themselves. That's crazy. So their basic obligation is to make a decision. But now they have a problem. Why? Because they're stuck in an inherent suffix for the Rashbam. An intrinsic suffix. Because both Rami and Ezra actually have full rights. Because Yaakov gave it to them. Ah, so then according to the Rashbam, you have a machloket. The right answer is definitely not recusal. Because why would you recuse yourselves? You know the situation and it's not going to change. So you have to make a decision. So then the question is, when both Rami and Ezra have equal rights to it, what choice do you have? So there's two options. Yachloku, which is definitely right and wrong at the same time, meaning they both have 100% claim. So at some level it's right, at some level it's definitely wrong. But it pursues peace. That's Rav's solution. Shmuel's solution is just give it to somebody, right? Which is partially true and partially untrue, right? Right? That's Shmuel's solution. That's how the Rashbam understands the sugya. That if there's a temporary doubt as to what to do, but evidence may emerge, so recusal is legitimate. If you're stuck in a fundamental suffix and no evidence could ever emerge, so then you must make a decision, and then you can divide on whether you make an arbitrary decision, simply move on with life, whether you make a compromise which is peaceful but definitely not exactly the truth, right? That's essentially how the Rashbam sees the difference between Zelmer Shavotai and Shtei Shtarot, which is recusal is only an option when evidence might come in the future, so it's only a temporary recusal. But recusal can't be an option where no evidence will ever come, and therefore recusal is a choice to stay in chaos. You can't do that. Then you have to make a choice, and then you can divide which is better. That's how Rashbam understands the sugya. Now, Tosfos can't quite understand it this way, because remember, let's just review Tosfos. Look back at Tosfos, Shmuel, Amar Shuda Dedaini. Let's reread Tosfos. Remember, Tosfos doesn't seem to think that this is a fundamental machlokas. He thinks it's also epistemic. It's just that you don't know. Why? Because Shmuel Amar Shudda Dedaini, Hainu Kirabi Eliezer Da'amar Eide Mesira Karte. This is according to Eliezer who thinks that the critical moment is when you give it over. Dil Rabbi Meir Lohavir Amar Shudda, because according to Rabbi Meir who holds that it goes by the Khatima, you wouldn't say Shudda. Vinira dahad amar beverg nishayin azri katav leechad umatzal leechad deshamatzal lokana af alpi shishtar ha'echad nechdav kodem. That which we said, that if you have two documents and you give one first, whoever gets it first owns it, even if the second star, even if that star was written later, niradavka shayinu shenechdav yom echad, that's where they're both written on the same day. And therefore, the only critical moment is Mesira, because what's written in the Shar is the same. Hilka hakodem b'Mesira zacha ho ve'nikr mitoch ha'shtar ha'echad shekada. Aval nichtav v'shtei yomim, if they're written on two different days, lo zeh shenichtav tchila kana. Then whichever one the document says gets it first. Shenikr mitoch ha'chatima shezeh nichtav kodem. Aval mishez masar lezeh v'tchila kana. De'achar kach kishemasar lezeh, gam lezeh zacha mishal chatima. Because Eide Mesira Karte is retroactive. When you give it to them, they acquire it retroactively from when it was written. And therefore, if Yaakov had written it to Rami on Sunday and Ezra on Monday and given it to Ezra on Tuesday and Rami on Wednesday, it would still belong to Rami. Because even according to Eide Mesira, it's retroactive. The ownership takes place from Mesira, but retroactive to Chatima. So since he wrote it to Rami on Sunday, once he gave it to on Wednesday, it was retroactive to Sunday, which overrides Ezra's Tuesday to Monday, if that makes sense. The Hachi Kamar Abai Berakama Dama Mitzieda Bechodam of Zachin Lova Hasha the Shaber the Shmuel Sever Hachi Kibril Azar Berakama Dama Mitzieda Dachi Gemar Lukmei Shmuel Ka Abai. Okay, I won't get into that machloket. Fine. And then in the second one, he says Shuda Dedaine. Nira l'Rabbeinu Tam l'misha yirta adayin litein. Give it to whoever you want. V'lo kipeir shakontra shayom du daito shal notein. Now he quotes from Inchananel, who says you only say shuda by karka, which is not true. Fine. Now, right, so according to Tosfos, you're going to have to say it's a little bit different, because according to him, it sounds like there is maybe a right answer, right? But maybe not, because if you assume they gave it to them on the same, right? Well, according to Tosfos, what you'll probably have to say is that the maskana is, look, the Hav Amina was, you could eventually prove it. How could you prove it? By proving who Yaakov gave the document to first. But the maskana will have to be that, no, since Mesira retroactively gives it to them on Chatima, on the end of the day, you won't be able to prove it. Why not? Because if he gives it to both Ezra and Rami, and they both acquire it retroactively from whenever it was signed, if it was signed on the same day, then it will create a definitional suffix. I guess that's how Tosfos is going to have to solve it. I'm not 100% sure. Okay. But a totally different approach emerges from the Yad Ramah. So look at source number 7. Yes. Yeah, exactly. And therefore, it would be that in the end of the day, you, right, meaning in his, Tosfos is maskana, right, not pure Mesira, but Mesira retroactive to Chatima, right? So then it would make sense that you could create a definitional suffix between you and Rami. Well, no, because they'll both go back to the Chatima, and on the day of the Chatima, Yaakov still owned it and had the right to give it to both of you. Right? Because he wrote two shtar on that day when he still had control.
So, does that mean that someone works, because you were just saying that both battles in that sense?
Right, that's clearly how Rashbam holds it. And the Maskana Tosfos might have to say it also. In the Havamin, he clearly doesn't. I don't know, right? Meaning the Gemara seems to make a big deal of the fact that it's a present, maybe for that reason, right? That as a sale, that's just illegitimate, right? As a present, right, maybe it's more okay to create complete chaos. I don't know. Okay, but that is the Rashbam and maybe Tosfot. Let's try the Yad Ramah. So remind me who the Yad Ramah is, just a minute here on biography. Who's the Yad Ramah? Remind me. What? The Yad Ramah. Number 7 here. Remember, we've seen him before. Reb Meir Halevi Abulafia. Ezra is my bio person. Yes, remind us when he lived. Yes, Meir ben Tudrus Halevi Abulafia. There you go. Right, 1170 to 12 what? 40 what? 1244. Not bad. 74 years. Not bad. In that time. Okay. In Spain. So the Yad Ramah takes a different approach. How does he say it? So look at 7. Umayshna mishtei shtarot ayotzim biyom echad dirav amrei achlokul shmuel omer shuda didainei. So the Gemara answered, ha'tam lekam lemekam Allah demilta. You can't prove it there. What does that mean? So he says, "Sha'afilu nidbarer shezeb bishachret v'zeb bein ha'arbayim, ein hakdama bishaot ela b'Yerushalayim." He said, even if you could prove that Yaakov had written the document for Rami in the morning and Ezra in the afternoon, it wouldn't matter, right? We've already talked about this because, like the Rashbam, there's no hakdama bishaot. Hours don't matter outside Yerushalayim. It goes by days. And maybe you'll say that what should you look at? Who did Yaakov give the deed to first? Did he give it to Rami first or Ezra? Kevan dismanan biyom echad mistama ba'u yoma udemasar hu. No, we assume that he gave it on the same day. Umilta de lo shchiyachi. Now this, I think, really does work much better for Tosfot. Because according to Tosfot, in theory, you could figure out who owned it first, right? That seems to be what Tosfot is definitely saying in his question, though he might have backtracked in his answer, right? But if you really think Eidim Misirikarti, then it should matter who gets it first. And therefore, isn't it possible to prove it? Hilkach pastinen le ledina beinayu, lirav ki taimei shmuel ki taimei, aval hacha ikam lamekam ala demilta, temaiti chad minayu sade davatei, umakmin la biyade, vetruch vedina mechdei lomad tarchinan. So the Yad Ramah seems to distinguish himself from the Rashbam in two ways. One, that the Rashbam says the difference is between something which is a definitional suffix versus something which is just a temporary suffix. Right? The Rashbam says that a definitional suffix, Bezdin can't be wrong, so you might as well make a decision. A situational suffix, an epistemic suffix, you might be proven wrong, so you can recuse yourself. That was point one. The Yad Ramah doesn't seem to agree to that because he says, no, it doesn't mean that you couldn't theoretically prove it. Because if you hold Eidim Misirikarti, you really hold Eidim Misirikarti, then it matters who Yaakov gave it to at first. And therefore, both in the case of Zeh Omer Shel Avotai v'Zeh Omer Shel Avotai and the case of Sheshart, is it theoretically possible to prove? Yes. Right? Because according to the Ramah, if you hold Eidim Misirikarti, then it really does matter whether Yaakov gave the deed to Ezra first or Rami first. If he gave it to Ezra first, it's Ezra's. If he gave it to Rami first, it's Ezra's. But what does he say? And I want to tease out his argument. He says the difference is not definitional suffix versus situational suffix. It's how likely it is that you will get a get an answer. He says, in the case where Andrew and Gavi both claim that their land is theirs, he thinks there's a high likelihood that, give it a few months, and Gavi or Andrew will dig up evidence. In the case of Rami and Ezra with the document, it's possible that Ezra will come up with evidence that Yaakov gave him the document earlier than Yaakov gave the document to Rami, but it's unlikely. Now, tell me, why would it make a difference? I understand the Rashbam, that when there's a definitional suffix, so there, Beis Din can't recuse themselves because nothing's ever going to change. Where there's a temporary suffix, they can recuse themselves. Why would you say that Beis Din can recuse themselves in a case where it's likely that evidence will emerge, but they shouldn't recuse themselves in a case where it's unlikely for evidence to emerge? Why does that matter? Now remember, why did the Rashbam say what he said? Because he said it's the difference between, he said if the truth will come out, you don't want to pursue untruth, right? Because you'll be proven wrong, and that'll undermine their authority, right? But if they can never be proven wrong by definition, so that doesn't undermine their authority, so they might as well make a decision. Why would you say that there's a difference between how likely is it that evidence will emerge? So what's the Yad Rama's answer to that? He says it's not about undermining the integrity of Beis Din, where it's about definitional versus just situational sveiko. Look at what his last line was. Atruche beidina bichdei lo mitzarchinan. He has a much different conception. What is itruche beidina bichdei lo mitzarchinan? What's a tircha? A burden. You don't burden the court for no reason. What does that mean? So he has a very different conception. He says it's not about undermining their truth, right? He says no. It's a much more balabatish svara. It goes like this. If Andrew and Gavi are both arguing that their plot of land, the plot of land in question is theirs, land is one of those things that, like, evidence, there is evidence somewhere. Somewhere, if you dig through the files, you'll find a deed. And they're claiming that it's their ancestral homeland. That means that you need to find witnesses somewhere on the planet that saw either Andrew's father or grandfather or Gavi's father or grandfather on that land. That's the type of evidence that it might take a month, it might take 6 months, it might take a year, but it'll show up. So the Yad Rama says, you know why we let Beis Din recuse themselves? Because this is basically an exercise in futility. There's going to be evidence. So why would you make Beis Din go through the whole charade of a court case on minimal evidence when evidence is probably going to show up in a few months that'll make the decision easier, quicker, more truthful, more effective, right? On every level, it'll be more effective. For him, the problem is, why deal with a case with minimal evidence when evidence will probably show up? All you're doing is wasting the court's time. If that's your main concern, which is don't make Beis Din get involved in less effective court cases when there will probably be a more just, more effective, better case later on, then you don't have to distinguish on fundamental grounds. What do you need to explain about the Shnei Shtarot case? What does the Yad Rama say? It's unlikely that evidence will show up. It's not impossible. But why does that matter? Right? He has a very coherent argument. What's his argument? If it's unlikely that evidence will show up, then remember, what did we say? Remember, what did we say? Beis Din has a goal called Chayim, which is let's get society moving. Let's just go through the logic. If evidence will probably emerge in the next 6 months, by recusing ourselves temporarily, are we freezing time? Are we basically hamstringing the legal system? No, because it'll probably come up in the next few months. So what are we doing? If we get involved in it now, we're wasting our own time. We're potentially posturing a way that's untrue, right? This is not contributing to peace because the truth is going to come out, right? On every plane, it's not worth it. But if it's unlikely that evidence will show up, even though it's possible, so then by not posturing, are we hamstringing the continuing functioning of society? Yes. Not definitionally, but if what you care about is practical, that the court's job is to make society function, so if it's possible but very unlikely that evidence will ever show up, so then by recusing yourself, you're basically 90% committing yourself to, right, deadlock, right, gridlock, which is pointless. So therefore, what should society do? Poskin, because it's not pointless, right? It's pointless if you're going to have a better judgment in 6 months, which will be more, which will fulfill every one of the court's goals. Truth, peace will be better in 6 months, right? But if it's very unlikely, not impossible, but unlikely that a better decision will emerge, so then Bezdin's commitment to getting things done will force them to make a decision, right? Right? It's a pragmatic concern, right? Think about it. He's making a pragmatic argument. He says Bezdin is committed to basically making things function. If probably evidence will emerge, so then we're not committing to anarchy. We're just recusing ourselves until things are clear so that we can function better as a court. But if it's unlikely, even if it's not impossible, that more evidence will come to light, then by recusing ourselves, we're encouraging anarchy. So then we have to make a decision. And then you can argue what's the best decision, either one which favors peace at the expense of truth, which is Yachloku, or one that, as Rashi would have it, is like quasi-truth, which is do your best at figuring it out, or at least one that doesn't go against truth by making an arbitrary decision, right? You can debate. Is it better to go for a peaceful decision, which is not fully true, not fully untrue? Or, as Rashi would have it, again, do your best based on the evidence that you have, understanding that it's not the best, but it aims towards justice even if it's not perfect. Or, as Rabbi Natan would have it, which is, look, don't paskin yachloku, because then you're definitely facilitating a 50% injustice. But make a decision. And if it's arbitrary, okay, so it's arbitrary, but it's arbitrary, which... it might be true, it might be untrue, but at least gets society moving and doesn't definitionally facilitate a 50% injustice, even if it has a 50% chance of facilitating 100% injustice, right? And you could have it, right? And you understand why there might be a real argument. Do I prefer truth with 100% chance of facilitating a 50% injustice or facilitating a 50% chance at 100% justice or 100% injustice? You can argue which is better, which is worse, right? But you only do that when it's unlikely that a decision will come that's better than this, and then your overarching motivation, which is to get things done and move society forward, overrides your concerns and makes you make a decision. And when things are messy, so obviously you have to give up one value over the other, and you can, with integrity, argue which one's better, right? But therefore, because the Yad Ramah is much more pragmatic for him, it doesn't matter. It's not about definitional uncertainty. It's just, if it's likely that the truth will be revealed, so then we can sacrifice almost nothing by recusing ourselves. If it's unlikely the truth will come, more evidence will come to light, that by recusing ourselves we're encouraging anarchy, so then we have to make a decision. And then you can argue how you balance peace, justice, injustice, definite injustice, definite partial injustice, possible full injustice, but not definite injustice, and all those factors. You can argue about that, okay? And that seems to be the Yad Ramah's logic, distinguishing Zet, right, Gavi and Andrew arguing about their field versus Ezra and Rami arguing about what they were given as a gift from Yaakov. Yes, Ezra. According to? Yeah. So I don't know, right? I don't know if the Yad Rama would say that there comes a point at which, right, 5 years, 10 years, right? I could hear someone saying that according to the Yad Rama, right, at some point it's going to become, right, like, you know, if you, that maybe, right, you could find a case in which it would be unlikely that evidence would ever appear. Maybe. You could, I, it would be pure speculation to say that there the Yad Rama would say, change it? I doubt it, because we do have formal rules, but maybe, right? Maybe the Yad Rama would say you could come up with a case of Zerzhan Altai, Vizama Shalatai, where it really is unlikely. Like, we know that there was only one copy of the deed in the city, right? And we know that where all the deeds were kept, they were burnt, and then, everyone in the city was killed, and I don't know, right? Come up with a tragic case where no evidence will ever be procured. I don't know, right? Or you could just say, look, formally, this type of case is rarely of that variety, and therefore this is the rule. But, okay. Good, we finally got through the first case. Now let's set up the second case. Maybe we'll finish it tomorrow, maybe it'll take two more days, I don't know. The next case in the Gemara is, okay, Umay shna me'adetana machlef para bechamor v'yolda, v'chein amocher shechata v'yolda, the next question is, right, remind me, we saw this, but now that we've spent a lot of time on the first case, right, the next suffix that it wants to compare it to is Machlef Parah V'Chamor. So again, that's where, who wants to own the cow and who wants to own the donkey? Anyone have a straw? Which one? What? Cow. Our Wisconsin friend wants to own a cow. Okay, fine. So Yaakov owns the cow. Who wants to own a donkey? Ezra wants to own a donkey. Okay, Ezra got it first. Ezra wants to own a donkey. So, Yaakov and Ezra are trading a cow for a donkey. And, what? Yes, you end up with the cow. So Yaakov gives Ezra the cow, and now the donkey becomes his. Right? And now, actually, the other way around. Let's say, what, it doesn't matter. Right? And then you wake up the next morning and, or you go back and you discover that, right, because as soon as Yaakov gives the cow to Ezra, he acquires the donkey, right? Because of Chalipin, right? What happens? You only had one animal present when you did it, and then you find that the other animal gave birth. Now there's the $1 million question. Or really not. However much a baby cow is worth. $100, I don't know. 500, I don't know. If the animal gave birth before the transfer, it belongs to the original owner, right? And if the birth happened after the transfer, then it belongs to the new owner. But we don't know, right? So again, in this case, it's sort of parallel to Zemer Shavotai, Zemer Shavotai. Now, is it actually a case where there was no prior claim? No. Right, because Yaakov previously had claim to the cow, and therefore its child, and Ezra previously had claim to the donkey, and therefore its child, whichever one we decide is giving birth. Doesn't really matter. Right? So it's not exactly identical to Zelmer Shavotai, but it is sort of. Why is it sort of? Because both Yaakov and Ezra admit that they no longer want claim to the parent animal, because they're trading. Right? So they're both relinquishing their original claim because they're admitting there was a sale. The fact that Yaakov and Ezra admit there was a sale is enough to undermine the previous proof we might have had that you own the parent and therefore the child, because you acknowledge that you're in the middle of a transaction which will change the ownership. Right? So in that case, we say you divide the profits that come from the baby. Yes. Not physically, but yes, financially, you cut the baby in half. So why in that case is the solution Yachloku? Isn't that identical to a case where they've relinquished their claims and now they have a suffix? Right? So look at the Rashbam. Umay shnohadarav nachmanami machlif para bechamor. V'cheilin shemashach bala parayda chamor. Since the person who owned the cow took, right, pulled the chamor, nikneida parayda bala chamor, so the cow now goes to the person who owns the donkey, v'chol makom shehi, wherever it happens to be, dimetatlan nikneida b'chalipin, because chattel, movable objects can be bought through barter. Kiditnan b'kidushin kolanata damim ba'acher kevin shezocha zeh, that once one of the animals has been traded, the full transaction takes place. Ulekach, because of that, ena yadavar yadua havlad shelmihu. It creates a doubt as to who owns the child. Sharei lo ra'a dainet parato, because he hasn't seen the cow. Aval b'mechira b'damim, but when you sell for money, obviously lo mankid the minkid. He said, by money, this doesn't work. Right? It's only this trade case where you can create this suffix, because that's where the animal might still be in the original owner's house, which creates the suffix, even though the ownership has switched. Okay. So I'm going to leave the money case aside. So he says, "V'hilkach ein yadur b'shut miyada shere l'ra ota l'gei v'shad matan ma'ot." So we don't know who owns it. So why there do we say yachloku? V'ha'acha ikalam l'mekam alad emildim v'edim v'yad v'shut miyada. Filo achil amrin kol dam gvar v'kashlar av nachman. Right, so he says, in this case, apparently, evidence might emerge, because it's really not so hard. Right, if we know that Yaakov pulled the donkey at 10 o'clock, right? So now all we need is for witnesses to come to say, we saw the cow give birth either at 9:45 or 10:15. Right, that's all we need. So in this case, evidence might very well emerge that would tell you who the baby cow or the baby donkey belongs to. Therefore, it should be parallel to Zeromer Shavotai, Zeromer Shavotai, and therefore, what should the halacha be? You fight to the death over the baby. Animal. Baby animal. Just making that clear, right? So why do instead we say Yachloku? So tomorrow's goal is to answer the Gemara's very complicated phrase, which is, there is Drara Dimamona. Right? There's Drara de Mamona. And our goal tomorrow is to figure out what does Drara de Mamona mean. The Gemara says that in the case of the Mach Leparaba Chamor, the trade, they both have Drara de Mamona, whatever that means. But in the case of the field, they do not have Drara de Mamona. That's our goal for tomorrow. So focus on Tosvot, right? What we're going to do is focus on the two Tosvotim. Tosvot, the first Tosvot deals with the following, the second Tosvot deals with Drara d'Mamona. The first Tosvot deals with a different question, which is, in the case, there is a machlokas in general, whether we hold Yachloku or not. In some other cases, does this prove that we hold Yachloku elsewhere? Start with the second Tosfos tomorrow, the Tosfos of Drara d'Mamona. Read, make sure to see the Rashbam and Tosfot. Yeah, okay. So get through that. If you manage to get through that, so then just see Rashi and Bava Metzia, because we haven't yet dealt with the factor of Ikar Amai. We touched on it in Tosfot, but it doesn't come up in our sugya, but it does in Bava Metzia. And there's one line in Tosfot about Munach Shad Shiyabo Eliyahu. I'm going to say I'm hopeful we can finish tomorrow, but I'm acknowledge that that might not happen, because often these things go on. It'll definitely not take more than 2 days, I think. But it might be tomorrow. I'm open to both those possibilities, okay? Fine, but that's your goal tomorrow, is to understand at least these Shitot of Drara d'Mamona, Rashbam, Tosvot. And the Tosvot that contrasted, if you can, with the case of Sumchos, which is the last Tosvot here on Lamed Hey Amud Aleph. Okay, let's go for tomorrow.